This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. It's time for Law and Behold, our series aimed at improving constitutional literacy among Malaysians, done in collaboration with the Malaysian Bar and the University of Malaya's Faculty of Law. And in this, our third episode of the series, Emeritus Professor Datuk Dr. Syed Salim Faruqi and Lim Wei Jet, who is the Deputy Chair of the Bar Council's Constitutional Law Committee, joined me to discuss the role and function of the Yang di-Pertuan Agong and the state rulers under the Federal Constitution of Malaysia. Just a note, this episode was actually recorded before the government's decision to withdraw from the Rome Statute. So please do bear that in mind. And here are the two gentlemen. So yes, today we're going to talk about the privileges and rights of rulers. So I think that has come into, I mean, there's a lot of talk now because, you know, we've signed on to the Rome Statute, and there's a lot of arguments for and against it. Wijit, I know you wrote a very nice article about it. We'll get into that. So
Prof. Shah also wrote a very, very brilliant article. I'd like to point that out.
Okay, all right. And we're going to get...
I quoted from him.
We're a symbiotic, yeah. So we'll talk about it. So, I mean, just to talk about the Constitution, I think it's Article 38 of the Federal Constitution that provides the members of the Conference of Rulers with particular rights. Am I correct?
Yes, yes. On this ICC issue... There is a lot of emotion and not that much reason. There are a lot of politics. The allegations are that the ICC treaty will affect the position of the Yang di-Pertuan Agong, of the Sultans, of the Malays, Islam, and that the treaty should have been, first of all, approved by the Conference of Rulers. Mm-hmm. With all due respect, most of these statements have no basis in law. Okay. Most of these allegations have no basis in law, though, of course, they have a lot of popular support. I don't think the ICC treaty in any way impacts on Islam or the special position of the Malays or the rulers. The rulers are not involved in the army. They are not in charge of the army or the police. They don't sign international treaties. Mm-hmm. Because that's in federal hands. Mm-hmm. So... the main issue would be the position of the Yang di-Pertuan Agong, because he is the supreme head of the federation under Article 32. And under the ICC treaty, heads of state, heads of government, officials do not have any immunity anymore.
Okay.
They would be subject to prosecution. Mm-hmm. So here is one danger then. Supreme head of the federation, Yang di-Pertuan Agong, is the supreme commander of the armed forces, Article 41. Then the Armed Forces Council acts under his general authority, Article 137, Clause 1. So could he, like President al-Bashir of Sudan, be prosecuted and convicted if rogue soldiers, either internally or, let us say, in service abroad for the United Nations, commit wrongs? Could the Yang di-Pertuan Agong be vicariously held responsible? Mm-hmm. My humble view is this, that actually there is no such danger. The Yang di-Pertuan Agong is not an absolute monarch.
Okay.
He acts on advice under Article 40, Clause 1, 40, Clause 1A. The other factor that must be borne in mind is that in law there is a distinction between the person in whom power is vested, in whom power lies, and the person who exercises the power.
Right.
There's a distinction. Uh-huh. So to give you a very ordinary example, the Yang di-Pertuan Agong is the chancellor of University Technology Mara. But surely all the powers relating to convocation, conferment of degrees are done in his name, but by others. Right. So his role as commander-in-chief or as supreme head of the federation or as... the head of the Armed Forces Council are basically performed by others, though in his name.
Mm-hmm.
Also, bear in mind, the ICC goes after real culprits.
Right.
It doesn't go after those who are ceremonial heads. It goes after those who were actively involved in the commission of the crimes. Bashir, Omar al-Bashir of Sudan's position is surely different from our Tuanku Yang Di Pertonagong. Bashir has been in power for 30 years. Mm-hmm. Along with that, he was also, till I think 2 weeks ago, the head of the political party. Our Yang Di Pertonagong is there for 5 years as Yang Di Pertonagong, and he's a constitutional monarch. Also, please bear in mind, other constitutional monarchies have signed, 14 sovereign states where we have constitutional monarchies have signed, amongst them, Cambodia, Jordan, Japan, and of course there are quite a few others, UK, Sweden, Spain, Samoa. So if other constitutional monarchs, 14 of them could sign. I understand absolute monarchs did not sign because they are actively involved in all affairs of state. But sure, constitutional monarchs, 14 of them have signed. And then Jeet correctly pointed out in his article that this is not the first time that we, by we I mean Malaysia, has signed an international treaty which does not give immunity to the head of state. Mm-hmm. The Genocide Convention of 1948 was ratified by us in 1994.
Okay.
25 years ago, there has been no trouble. And Genocide Convention has a lot in common with actually the ICC, because ICC Convention also deals with genocide. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I personally think that a lot of this is storm in a teacup. It is manufactured. There is really no threat. Unless, of course, the Yang Di Pertonagong, God forbid, would actively take part in the four crimes that are specifically pointed out in the treaty, and that is genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, and crimes of aggression. By far and large, and that's my final point, very peaceful country. Those who don't commit war crimes have nothing to fear. In this country, fortunately, no region, no religion, mm-hmm. no race is at war with the federal government. Unlike, let's say, God forbid, in Pakistan, in Lebanon, in Syria, in Sri Lanka, in southern Thailand, in southern Philippines. So I don't think there is anything to fear. It's like I have nothing to fear from the law of murder because I have no intention of committing any murders. But if it is my intention to commit murders, then of course I would be very wary of the law of murder.
Just to bolster a few points. I think firstly we need to recognize that the concept that our rulers possess absolute immunity is a thing in the past. So in 1993, amendments were made to the constitution to yep. allow criminal proceedings to be instituted against the Yang Di Pertonagong and
right.
also the rulers through special courts. So there are special procedures involved, there are special requirements, but at the end of the day, there is no absolute immunity to the rulers to begin with, and okay. they can be held accountable for crimes. Mm-hmm. So this whole proposition that the immunity of rulers are being jeopardized or taken away, it cannot hold water because there is no absolute immunity in the
yes.
first place.
Mm-hmm.
The second point to note is that in the Rome Statute, the International Criminal Court only assumes jurisdiction mm-hmm. when the state itself is unwilling or unable to carry out investigations and prosecutions.
Right.
Look at Article 17 to 19 of the Rome Statute. Hence, the Rome Statute would only come into the picture if, for example, Malaysia's investigation authorities or our special courts are unable or unwilling to prosecute said ruler in a hypothetical
okay.
situation.
Sure.
So in that sense, the International Criminal Court complements our national investigation agencies and judicial system. It does not seek to overrule or displace our system in which are already existing. So there is a high degree of deference given to domestic proceedings mm-hmm. before it can reach to the ICC. So in that sense, parties do not need to be afraid that this ICC will swoop down in third world Malaysia and try to, you know, interfere in our rulers and our government. It doesn't happen and doesn't function that way.
Mm-hmm.
The third point to make is, and this is a theory in international law, there is force in the argument that immunities, while meant to enable the beneficiary to carry out official functions, cannot and should not extend to protect people who commit torture, very heinous crimes like genocide or war crimes. So in 2001, the UK House of Lords, in the Pinochet case, Pinochet was a dictator in Chile at one point in time. He fled to the UK after he was deposed. And there was an attempt to extradite him back to Chile for him to face justice. So he contested that extradition and it went all up to the UK's highest court. And the UK House of Lords said this: since immunity bestowed to a head of state under domestic law only extends to his official functions, and torture is certainly not part of his official functions, therefore, Pinochet was not entitled to that particular immunity from extradition.
Right.
So it makes sense that way. So therefore, the Rome Statute, the royal institutions, our constitution, I would argue, can exist very, very harmoniously. There is no need to fear for any kind of dereliction of immunity that we hear so strong nowadays.
Okay, I mean, another argument was that the Agung was simply informed of this decision to accede to the Rome Statute rather than actively consent to it. Was his consent necessary in this case?
Yanggi Pertuan Agong's consent is necessary to legislation. Mm-hmm. So if the statute is converted ultimately into legislation, then of course his consent would be needed. But the act of signing the treaty is an executive act where under the constitution, the Agong's consent is not needed.
I see.
It's like an international agreement. You sign MOUs, MOEs all the time. Trade agreements are signed. They are not submitted to the Agong. In all this, in all these objections, there seems to be an underlying belief that the Yangdi Pertuan Agong or the sultans are absolute monarchs, and every decision must go through them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with all due respect, that is not so since Malaya became independent in 1957. An absolutist monarchy was converted into a constitutional monarchy. Or may I correct myself? Many absolute monarchies, we had several of them.
Several, yes.
Yes, they were converted to a constitutional monarchy. Though, of course, there were some areas where discretionary powers were retained.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, what are those discretionary powers?
In the case of the Yangdi Pertuan Agong, the position is different from the position of the sultan. Sultans in their states have more power, surprisingly, more discretion than the Yangdi Pertuan Agong. But in the case of the Yangdi Pertuan Agong, the powers are divisible into two broad categories. Number one, those which he exercises on advice, either advice of the Prime Minister or advice of other bodies like the Pardons Board or the Islamic Affairs Council. Or there's a third category, he acts on the advice of the Prime Minister, but after consultation. Consultation is not the same thing as consent.
Right.
Consultation with the Majlis Raja Raja. There are, on the other hand, hundreds of provisions which confer or seem to confer power on him, but actually those are merely, his role is merely ceremonial. Appointment of cabinet, the constitution says Yangdi Pertuan Agong shall appoint 44 senators, signing bills, but all these are non-discretionary. So your question was, what are the discretionary powers?
Yeah.
Well, the most important are, he appoints the Prime Minister after an election. Here again, I have to say this to you, while almost everyone thinks that this is an absolute power, actually it's not so. Under Article 43, Clause 2, Subclause A, the Constitution provides the structure within which this discretion must be exercised. The Prime Minister-to-be must not be a citizen by naturalization. He has to be citizen by operation of law. Number two, the Prime Minister-to-be must be a member of the lower house, Dewan Rakyat.
Mm-hmm.
He cannot belong to the Senate, unlike Lord Home in the UK, who was from the House of Lords, and yet he was appointed as Prime Minister. Number three, the person who's appointed Prime Minister must, in the opinion of the Yangdi Pertuan Agong, command the confidence of the members of the House.
Okay.
So there are 222 MPs, 112, in the opinion of the King, must support the Prime Minister. Now, if there is a clear-cut majority for a particular person, then the Yangdi Pratonagong's role is not discretionary anymore. He has, by convention, to accept whoever is, whether he likes the person or not. But if it is a hung parliament,
right,
when nobody has a clear majority, then, of course, the windows are open for exercise of discretion where the Agong's personal choice could alter the course of history. So, appointment of PM, premature dissolution of the Dewan Rayat, that's a second area where the king has wide discretion. He can say no, though normally he doesn't. Normally he allows the government of the day. These are called conventions.
Okay.
Conventions, constitutional custom. Number three, summoning the Majlis Raja Raja to discuss a matter of special significance to their majesties. There are a few other areas. He can seek any information from the government, and no official secrets act can apply to the Yangdi Pratonagong's instruction to supply information. He can delay bills by 30 days under Article 66(4)(a). Some appointments like Public Service Commission, Education Service Commission, Election Commission, the Constitution specifically gives to the Agong a discretion here. So the way it would work is the Prime Minister will nominate, but the Agong has some discretion here, especially in the case of the Public Service Commission, Education Service Commission. The Agong may, in his discretion, appoint. In the case of the Election Commission, the language is a little bit vague. The Agong shall ensure, the Yangdi Pratonagong shall ensure that the appointee enjoys public confidence. So there is some hint here that the king must consciously and conscientiously vet this nominee. There are possibly, though controversially, there are possibly other powers which are not mentioned in the Constitution, but which every constitutional lawyer will acknowledge may well exist. We call them residual prerogative, because I would like to quote to you the views of our late Sultan Azlan Shah when he was a judge. He once wrote that a king is a king, and you cannot confine the king's powers to simply those laid down in the Constitution. So I would agree that in some areas there is scope for residual or non-written, unwritten prerogative, non-textual rights. Because right, as we have noted in one of the earlier sessions, life is always larger than the law. And there will always be situations where a clear-cut situation, I'm sure you'll agree with me, the Constitution is thunderously silent about caretaker government. Because it says the Prime Minister shall be a person who commands the confidence of the lower house, but there's no more lower house once Parliament is dissolved. So where does the Prime Minister come from? So we have followed a British convention. The previous Prime Minister shall continue in office. But that's a convention. That's not law. It's entirely possible. The King may say, though it would be a very revolutionary situation, the King may say, thank you very much. Take a break and please improve your golf. In the meantime, I will appoint a caretaker government of a neutral person.
If I may just elaborate on the position of the rulers, the powers of the rulers, which are slightly different from the Yangdi Pratonagong.
Yes.
So, similar to the Yangdi Pratonagong, their powers, they are largely ceremonial in nature, and they must act on the advice of the Menteri Besar in the case of rulers, not the Prime Minister.
Okay.
So, but there are certain exceptions where the rulers themselves can exercise discretion. And in fact, the 8th schedule of our constitution provides for those exceptions. So, number one, in the appointment of the Menteri Besar. Mm-hmm. So, similarly, he has a discretion to choose so. Secondly, withholding the consent on the dissolution of the state legislative assembly. Thirdly, he can request a meeting of a conference of rulers to discuss the privileges, honours and matters of religion. Mm-hmm. He does not need to have the consent of the Menteri Besar to do so. Fourthly, he has a discretion in his function as the head of Islam in his state and the custom of Malays. Number five, in the appointment of heirs, consorts, regents, or the council of regency, he has the ultimate say. The appointment of persons to Malay customary ranks, titles, and honours, this would, I suppose, be Dato' Sri or Tan Sri titleships.
Titleships, right?
Yeah, he has absolute discretion. And last but not least, in the regulation of royal courts and palaces. So palace matters, he has discretion. So it is in these exceptions that he can exercise his discretion.
Okay, yeah. So...
And his discretion is much broader than that of the Yang.
Yes, yes, yes.
For example, on the matters of Islam, the constitution says clearly king shall act on the advice of the Islamic Affairs Council, but I understand the sultans have much greater power in the area.
Yes.
And are there any areas where the... You said that sometimes the Conference of Rulers actually have slightly more power than the Yang Dipertuan Agong. Is that accurate?
I was saying the sultans.
The sultans themselves.
But you're right, the Conference of Rulers in some areas actually is above the Yang Dipertuan Agong. Mm-hmm. They elect him, they can dismiss him.
Right. So those are some of the... And also, if anything to do with laws altering, like the boundaries of a state, for example, or anything that might affect the privileges or the position of the rulers, that will fall under the Majlis Raja Raja?
Yes, I believe so. Under the Conference of Rulers, there are certain powers that they have. Mm-hmm. One of them is when there is a proposal to alter the boundaries of a state.
Right? Yeah, I'm very passionate about this topic of Conference of Rulers, but I think this is a very unique institution. There are about 25 or so other monarchies, and I think our Majlis Raja Raja is really very, very unique. It dates back to 1897 when it first met in Kuala Kangsa, in the citadel of the Sultan of Perak. And I think it's a unifying, dignifying, and stabilizing institution. I think it has a tremendous potential. And most respectfully, I wish to say that potential has not been fully realized.
To explain.
Yes. I think it is, in some respects, a constitutional auditor.
Okay.
It is, in some respects, a check and balance institution. It is in some respects an institution that can keep an eye on the Yang Dipertuan Agong's conduct in his office. Mm-hmm. It's an institution which elects the Yang Dipertuan Agong. It has, though there are specific procedures, ultimately the discretion of the Conference of Rulers is very broad. It can even dismiss the king. And I think this is most unique, that the king can be dismissed. It has a legislative veto.
Okay.
But I must clarify, not over all laws, only about 11 sets of laws, which mostly relate to the ruler's rights. Or you were talking about boundaries of a state, Article 2B. You want to take Wilaya Persekutuan away from Selangor.
Yeah.
You have to get the consent of the Selangor Assembly plus of the Majlis Raja Raja.
So everybody.
So yes, the boundaries of the state, the Majlis Raja Raja protects. It has a veto power over some laws or amendments which we would in this country call so-called sensitive issues. The application of sedition law in Parliament, provisions relating to Bahasa Melayu, provisions relating to special position of Malays and the natives of Sabah Sarawak, Article 153. But please bear in mind, the Majlis Raja Raja is not only involved with its rights and with the position of the Malays, but also with citizenship, everyone's citizenship. Mm-hmm. The parliament, the government and parliament cannot do in this country what Idi Amin tried to do in Uganda or Jomo Kenyatta tried to do in Kenya, because citizenship provisions require the consent. Any amendment will require the consent of the Majlis Raja Raja. Mm-hmm. The power of pardon, not in general, the power of pardon, pardoning the Agong or the sultans or their consorts if they have been prosecuted under Article 182 to 183. Ultimately, the Majlis has the power to pardon the brother rulers. And finally, the appointment of the special court that was mentioned earlier. Sultans, Agong are tried in a special court. 2 out of 5 judges of the special court will be appointed by the Majlis Raja Raja. These are the areas where the Majlis has overriding powers. Mm-hmm. However, there are other areas, and there is some confusion there in popular minds, where actually the Majlis's role is advisory, cautionary, or consultative. But many people believe that it is more like an overriding veto power. What are these? On many constitutional appointments, judges, Auditor General, Public Service Commission, Education Commission, Election Commission, the Majlis is consulted. But as I submitted earlier, consultation doesn't mean consent. Mm-hmm. The Prime Minister can still insist on his choice. Extension of Islamic acts to the federation as a whole. Islam is in the state list, but they may agree to have Hari Raya on the same day. But a sultan actually may say, no, I want Hari Raya on a different date in my state. But Majlis can agree to the extension of an Islamic practice or an Islamic act throughout the federation. Mm-hmm. Majlis can discuss national policy and any other matter that it thinks fit. It can discuss, but it cannot decide.
I see.
It can discuss. It can bring to bear its authority, its wisdom on a particular matter. It can ask questions, it can seek information, and the government cannot refuse. But we have to bear in mind, under Article 38, Clause 2, Majlis has the power to discuss this. And of course, because of the prestige of its office, the long years the sultans serve, it's a position for life, unlike the Yangdi Pertonagong. There's a large potential for statesmanship, for providing check and balance, for promoting unity, for building bridges of friendship and cooperation, for tearing down walls of separation and suspicion. Mm-hmm. For example, was it last year, some businessmen want to have a laundromat unto orang Islam sahaja.
Yes.
And it's a matter of pride for me to take note that the Sultan of Johor and the royal family in Perlis took note of this impropriety and said, you cannot do that in our state. The Sultan of Perak, on many, many occasions, His Majesty delivers speeches about the need for moderation, the need for understanding and unity. So I think there is a tremendous prestige surrounding this office. The citizenry, in not just Malay citizenry, have a lot of regard for the Sultan, and I think they can play a much greater role than their Majesties have played. But there are other examples where they have taken a stand. For example, the Conference of Rulers issued a public statement expressing concern about 1MDB.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they did, yeah.
I think that's the kind of thing that the Majlis can do and should do more often.
Because, mm-hmm. I mean, when they did make that statement, the impact was felt. It was so strong, you know, because before that it was largely, I mean, there was largely no sort of comment from them before that. Especially in matters relating to that. Anything you wanted to add to that, Wijay?
No. I think Prof. Shad has covered it fine. He covered it very, very good. Like, I concur with him that the sultans should, if the matters, a serious matter arises in the public discussion in Malaysia, they should take a stand to say, no, we do not agree with this kind of policies, etc., etc. But they, having said that, they should not take a very active role to comment on each and every policy of the government, because there are certain limitations, and we are a constitutional monarch. We don't want the royalty to have a larger share to say in the conduct of governing Malaysia than they should have.
Actually, what needs to be pointed out, that the role of the Conference of Rulers, the discretionary role, is confined to a number of topics. Mm-hmm. I outlined some of those topics to election of the king, dismissal of the king, legislative veto, but only in about 11 areas. Yeah. Power of pardon. In other areas, I totally agree. While their majesties can discuss and debate and express their opinion, caution, advise, warn, question, but they should not try to overrule the elected government, because that would lead to a battle of the turf. And in a situation like that, no one wins. No one wins. The famous statement long time ago that in wars there are no victories but varying degrees of defeats.
No, I think if you look at history, I think monarchies last and gain the respect and adoration of the public if they recognize that you know, you need to give the government of the day the free hand mm-hmm. to conduct the affairs of government, mm-hmm. and they should stay and advise in the back accordingly. I think long gone are the days where you have absolute monarchs who have ultimate authority to govern the country. I think those times have passed. We should move to an era where, you know, there is consultation between the government of the day and the royalty, and they have the minimal role that they can play.
Yes, I could just add one word here, one or two words. Besides being a historical institution, a political institution, a religious institution, it is also a moral institution. And I think it would be best to remember that.
Okay, thank you so much for joining me today.
Welcome.
So that was Emeritus Professor Dato' Dr. Syed Salim Faruqi and Lim Wei Jiat discussing the role and function of the Yang di-Pertuan Agong and the state rulers under the Federal Constitution of Malaysia. If you missed any part of this interview or any previous Live and Learn interviews, you can search for the podcast on our BFM app, available on Google Play and the App Store, and also on Spotify. This has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.